This is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Have you noticed that coverage from Syria seems to come in waves? Last week, it sounded like this.
Tonight, a bomb strikes at the heart of Syria's dictatorship.
That we could be in the closing stages of the civil war in Syria.
Potential collapse in Damascus, possibly, the speculation is, within the next 36 hours.
And this week, it sounds like this.
So much for those predictions that the Syrian regime would fall over the weekend.
Government fighters are streaming into Aleppo to try to crush the armed revolt as they did last week in Damascus.
If anyone thought President Assad was about to give up this fight, they have clearly been proven wrong.
The first few segments of this show deal generally with believing what you see and hear. As the battle for Syria has moved from Damascus to the more populous city of Aleppo, much of the global audience and the media are still relying on videos uploaded online to follow events on the ground. NPR Middle East correspondent Deb Amos joins us with some words of advice for the news-hungry web trawler.
Early on in this uprising, activists understood that the international media was not going to be able to cover this conflict. And so those citizen journalists, those activists, began to cover their own revolution. I have met many of them who began as the documentarians of a peaceful uprising. They have moved on to become the documenters of the armed conflict. Almost every rebel group in Syria has a media arm to document their armed struggle against the regime. And those are all now posted on YouTube.
So how has the general message of these videos changed?
These videos are a fundraising tool. If you want to mount a brigade, say 18, 20 guys, and you need the money to arm them, one of the ways that you get that money is that you produce a video of something that you've done in the field. Take over an army checkpoint, or at least challenge one. And those videos are posted on YouTube. And it's the way that you show your funders that you're doing what you said you were going to do.
And who are your funders?
They can be governments. They can be Muslim Brotherhood. It can be Syrian exiles who have an interest in bringing the regime down and are supporting rebel groups now.
There are as many Syrians out of the country as there are in it, right?
23 million to 23 million. That's just about what the numbers are. And in the past year, you have seen a remarkable organization on a political level. I have never seen this before. And it was, in the beginning, mostly humanitarian. They were paying for medicine, equipment to be smuggled into field hospitals. And now it's all about the guns.
So how does this work? A rebel commander needs more weapons. What exactly does he do?
Well, I'll give you an example of one that is on YouTube, and this is from the Farouk Brigade. It's quite a remarkable bit of propaganda. It's this commander riding on a Syrian tank. There's lots of young men along the roadway. They're all holding guns, brandishing them over their heads. They're all shouting, and there they are, victorious in a Syrian army tank. Now, nobody gave them that tank. They had to take that tank from the Syrian army. That is a sign that they have been successful. And so the idea is that that video goes up on YouTube, and groups around the world will send them money into bank accounts in Turkey, and then they can turn that into weapons and bring them across the border.
Are these various rebel brigades competing against each other for the same money, and does that play out in the videos?
Absolutely, they are. This is Darwinian. It's an armed beauty contest with different groups trying to vie for the limited funds that there are. It's the only privately funded revolution that I know of. And that's why these videos are so important. And because this is a conflict where there is not a lot of coordination between different commanders, they don't tell anybody that they're going to do this. And once a checkpoint is attacked, often there is indiscriminate shooting at anything that moves near the checkpoint. So it risks civilians and it risks other rebel units who don't know that it's coming. And so there are times when it is counterproductive to make your video for your donor.
We haven't talked about the Syrian government. How is it responding to this war, if not for hearts and minds, then for money? It has, on some occasions, shepherded foreign media around. You've been among them. What's its strategy, assuming that it has one?
It certainly has a very high-end propaganda strategy. when Damascus was engulfed in what the rebels called the Damascus volcano, Syrian TV ran a couple of reports that the sound that people were hearing were the celebrations before Ramadan, which is the month-long fast for Muslims. And certainly among activists on Twitter, people were just laughing out loud about, you know, nice try, Syrian government. You are under attack and you're trying to convince your supporters that this is simply a celebration. That was also clear as people were streaming out of Damascus into Lebanon. As reporters caught them at the border crossing, you could see who was a supporter of the government and who was not. Those who were supporters said to reporters, "Oh, nothing's happening in Damascus. I'm just going to the beach."
Deb, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Deb Amos is a Middle East correspondent for NPR. As combatants in Syria try to wrest control of the narrative in the near absence of journalists, in London, nearly 30,000 journalists and their staff have been drawn by the Olympic Games. But according to the International Olympic Committee, about a quarter of them are not actually accredited to cover the games. That leaves thousands free to report on everything from traffic jams to human interest stories to, well, whatever news they can squeeze out of the locale. And that's a chilling prospect for civic leaders. So, as Christopher Wirth reports, Olympic host cities increasingly try to shape the coverage those unaccredited reporters produce.
Glenn Curtin knows quite a bit about the distinction between accredited and non-accredited media. For 15 years, he was a press officer for the English Football Association. That's soccer to you and me. And he says there were always two types of journalists that covered big sporting events. There were the professional sports writers, and then there were those who covered everything else. They were called the rotters.
A rotter is an English slang term from the 19th century, I think. And all they were there to do was to write the bad news stories. And if they were bored or you did not keep them supplied with good stories, then they would certainly write the bad stuff.
Today, Curtin applies that same lesson here as project director for the London Media Center, a home away from home for the world's media during the Olympics.
And this is where journalists will come to file their copy.
This is not to be confused with the official Olympic Media Center. No, this one is for the rotters, where non-accredited journalists like me have been asked to get accreditation to be non-accredited journalists during the Games. So far, close to 8,000 unaccredited journalists have registered in London. And while accrediting the non-accredited may sound like an oxymoron, Gary Wannell, who tracks Olympic media coverage at the University of Bedfordshire, says more and more it's a way for host cities like London to wield some influence over this growing unofficial press corps.
These several thousand unaccredited journalists actually have the ear, the eye of the public every bit as much as the accredited ones. The perspective of an organising committee, they can't be left to roam around unchecked. And it's almost become an imperative, I think. You can't take the risk of just not knowing who is reporting and what they might be reporting.
For example, London's Olympic organizers would probably like to avoid embarrassing stories like the recent coverage of a botched Olympic security contract.
Private security firm G4S is taking a beating in the British media after news broke the firm would not be able to fulfill its security contract for the London Olympics.
Or perhaps the upcoming anniversary of the deadly riots that swept the UK last year.
Of riots. They describe it as the worst in current memory.
Martine Ainsworth-Wells is London's director of marketing. She says one only has to look at the 96 games in Atlanta and the bombing there to see just how badly the Olympic coverage can go.
Atlanta probably would admit that they didn't look after the non-accredited media as well as they should have. And the non-accredited media then kind of turned against the Atlanta Games. And Atlanta definitely has not gone down as one of the best games in our lifetime.
Host cities, she says, depend on positive Olympic coverage in order to reap the benefits of increased tourism and investment. She says that's why every host city since Atlanta has bent ever further backward to cater to non-accredited reporters. To that end, Glenn Curtin at the London Media Center says his goal is to make a journalist's job as pleasant and easy as possible, with free Wi-Fi, packaged news stories, and hundreds of media events, from cooking classes to shopping tours that are meant to showcase London.
If you're providing something that is ready digested, could be broadcast or written about as it stands, then you've got a good chance, because journalists are under pressure. They don't always have the length of time to write about things that they would like, and if they find something that suits the purpose, then we hope they'll use it.
Andy Maya of the University of West Scotland has studied the growth of non-accredited media at the Olympics.
A lot of the journalists that come here are actually quite willing and receptive to those kinds of promotional devices. And in fact, many of them probably rely on it.
To find out more, I went undercover and joined a media event billed as a restaurant safari, sampling different London restaurants. On the tour with me was Chinese TV reporter Xu Jufeng, along with a cameraman who filmed Xu as he described everything he ate for the viewers back home.
You know, the athletes, they compete together, but here, how shall I put it? That's the Food Olympic.
So the story is about the Food Olympics in London.
Yeah, the different flavors of the food.
And how those flavors compete. Later, Xu explained the feature is part of a series that depicts Britain for a Chinese audience.
So people are so concerned about the way the British people live.
And are you having trouble finding those stories?
It is organized by the London Media Center, and we receive the information from them.
It's exactly the kind of answer Glenn Curtin might like to hear. He says Chinese media make up the single largest group of non-accredited journalists in London for the Olympics. And if they're inclined to convince a billion Chinese viewers that London is a great place to visit, then Curtin says his job will be done. For On the Media, I'm Christopher Worth.
Coming up, a self-described media manipulator swears he's changed his ways, but not before he tells us the tricks and lies and bribes of his trade. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The London Summer Games are taking unprecedented steps to safeguard the security of their sponsors. For instance, Olympic Guard police were told to empty their snacks into clear plastic bags so they wouldn't inadvertently advertise competing brands. Officials backtracked after angry officers complained to their superiors. But it's a fair indication of the confusion and anxiety the new rules have wrought. Esther Adley, senior news writer for The Guardian newspaper, is covering the Olympics. Welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
So, The Independent reported that even as London was scrambling for staff to secure the Games, hundreds of highly organized, uniformed Olympic copyright cops stood ready to enforce the sponsors' marketing deals. Is that true?
It is true. There are just shy of 300 branding police, as they have been called, to patrol the venues where the competitions are being held and just check that there's nobody trying to sneak an unauthorized branding opportunity past the strict rules that have been put in place.
London organizers gave businesses a list of keywords to avoid.
That's right. There's two different lists. And you're not allowed to use two words from list one. And I'll tell you what those words are. Games, 2012 in words, 2012 in numbers, or 2012 in words. So you can't say, we're supporting the 2012 games here at the Dog and Duck in Hackney, because that has two words from that list. And also barred is using one of those words with one of the second list, which includes the words London, medals, sponsors, summer, and gold, silver, or bronze. So you can see that there's an awful lot of opportunity to fall into the trap where the organizers would deem that your marketing material or your advert was in breach of their law.
What are the potential penalties for violating these rules?
There's fines available up to about £20,000. And what's interesting about this law is it goes beyond kind of copyright law. This actually introduces a criminal offence, so you could technically be criminally prosecuted It's really been described as some of the most draconian legislation in this area that's ever been introduced. Some marketing experts have said we're getting into a situation where businesses aren't able to capitalize on this great economic opportunity because people are afraid almost to celebrate the games in that way.
Let's talk about how these rules would affect the athletes themselves. They have Twitter and Facebook accounts.
The athletes have been given quite clear rules about what they can and can't do on Twitter in this games time period. They can't mention the brands of their own personal sponsors if those sponsors aren't official Olympic sponsors.
So I scored some tickets. There was this fantastic moment. I caught it on my phone. Could I upload it? Could I send it to my friends?
If you are sitting in the Olympic Stadium, you have a great view of the 100 meters final, you happen to get a fantastic shot on your smartphone, they don't want you commercially exploiting that image. And they also don't want you uploading to YouTube 10 seconds of fantastic action that might be in its own way even more revealing than what the BBC or NBC cameras can show. But in most cases, posting certainly images will be fine to social media, I would think.
What do you think is the most extreme example of copyright protection that you've seen so far since this process was inaugurated?
You can't buy with any other credit card apart from Visa. And I noticed when I tried to buy a Coke, of course, from a machine the other day that even it wouldn't accept cash. I had to pay by Visa. So I don't know whether Visa see cash as a competitor. But some of those things arguably make life, if anything, just more difficult for spectators.
Esther, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Esther Adley is a senior news writer for The Guardian newspaper. The games are noisy. They should be. As Alexis Madrigal wrote recently for The Atlantic, what you see depends in part on what you hear. To be immersed in a performance on the uneven bars, we need to hear the slap of hands on wood and the bars flexing as the athlete twirls. Peregrine Andrews produced an audio documentary called The Sound of Sport that explains that some of what you'll be hearing is not exactly what you'll be seeing. Welcome, Peregrine.
Thank you.
Let's start with an example of the sound during the last London Olympics in 1948.
300 yards to go. Eriksson of Sweden leading and Strand right up at its shoulder. Three Swedes in front now. Slykhus fourth is catching the
I'm finding it interesting about all the Swedes, but I'm not hearing much in the way of sporting.
No. I'm not sure how many microphones they had access to. Probably very few. And it may have literally been one microphone on the announcer, and any sound that happened to accidentally get picked up, you know, was a bonus.
But now every detail of an event is recorded, even the flight of an arrow.
You can, if you listen carefully, clearly hear that three stages of the flight, the twang of the bow, and then the swish through the air, and then the thud of the arrow hitting the target. Most people probably haven't seen real arrows very often, but they have watched films, they have watched Robin Hood.
Look out!
And that kind of twang, swish, thud is quite possibly a movie-driven idea. But Dennis Baxter, who's the sort of lead sound designer on the Olympics, he felt that he needed to meet that. And so he did by just using a clever combination of microphones and very carefully putting a microphone underneath the flight path of the arrow.
Now let's listen to the sound of a gymnast.
What we're hearing there is the use of a thing called a contact microphone. So if you put one on a balance beam, a gymnast is walking along, you'll actually hear something that you would never hear naturally if you stood beside the beam. What you're actually picking up is the vibrations inside the beam. It's a kind of hidden world. And it was just an idea that Dennis had. By bringing out the flexing of the bar as the nervous feet make their way along it, it makes for something really intense.
But there are other examples where pre-recorded sounds are mixed into the sound of the event. This is a loop of horse racing that was used during live races.
There's practical reasons why they do this. Your camera lenses can pull in shots from, you know, a mile away with their zooms. You have no microphone that can do that. So the only way you could cover a huge range like that would be to use hundreds of microphones, which is impractical. Or you fake it.
Right.
And with horse racing, rather than put a load of microphones out across the track, they figured that they could use this kind of galloping horse's rumble it would fill in what you expect.
Some of those horses used in that loop might be dead.
Well, in fact, I was told when I sourced the recording that they may not even have been horses. They may have been buffalo.
But at least that's not during the Olympics. During the Olympics, we have the example, however, of rowing in the 1996 games in Atlanta. In that case, pre-recorded sound was used to create a more, quote, natural experience.
It's a case of meeting expectations. And if you're watching rowing on television, they're not showing you the helicopters, they're not showing you the chase boats. But all you can hear, if you have microphones placed along the course, is helicopters and chase boats, because they make an awful lot more noise than the rowing. Dennis and his team said, well, what should we give people? And I should make it clear that the use of these things is quite subtle and is generally mixed in with the natural sound.
Natural, though, isn't necessarily the same as authentic.
No, but I mean, what's authentic? Television isn't authentic. You know, pointing lenses and microphones at things doesn't capture reality. It captures a little sliver of reality.
I have to be careful here. We'll be cutting out your ums and my ahs, and even on our show, I will record ambience and sound and then read my text over it. But we wouldn't insert ambient sound that was recorded in another time and place. Like, we wouldn't put a marching band under you now, or maybe we would.
I'll tell you something interesting is I've worked in radio a lot. I then sort of halfway through my career started doing sound for TV. And the one thing I noticed was that you actually need a lot more sound. If you see someone slam a car door, if you don't hear a car door slam, it really disturbs you. Your brain will just go, there's something wrong. So you find when you're doing television post-production sound, a lot of those little, what you might call cheats go in, but that's not even to make it big and Hollywood and hyper-real. That's just to make it seem normal and right.
Peregrine, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Audio engineer and producer Peregrine Andrews is the producer of the audio documentary The Sound of Sport. As you just observed, we prefer to hear what we expect to hear. Harmless, perhaps, when looping the sound of horses, but it's a principle often applied by those who would exploit the weaknesses in our information ecosystem. That's according to Ryan Holiday, author of Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator. He confesses on page one to lying, conniving, and bribing the media on behalf of best-selling authors and billion-dollar brands. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, you're repentant.
In a way, yeah.
And yet, you confessed to planting false stories in a number of news outlets just prior to publishing the book. So, is this yet another manipulation for the benefit of Ryan Holiday?
The shorter answer is, if I wanted to manipulate people, I probably wouldn't write a book saying what a manipulator I am and giving away all my easy manipulation secrets.
Unless you were sick of doing it.
Right. And I am. And that's part of why I'm writing the book, to sort of end this party with a bang.
Briefly describe the business model of the internet that makes it so particularly easy to manipulate. Because let's stipulate, there was plenty of media manipulation before there was an internet.
Of course. But I think it's far more prevalent, far less noticed than it ever has been before. Blogs are paid by the page view. A blog has an infinite amount of content that it could produce, and every piece of content is more money in its pocket. So the equation is traffic times CPM, the amount they're paid per page view, equals their revenue. So it's this race to the bottom to get as many page views as humanly possible, and that pressure makes blogs do really bad, lazy things.
Okay, so let's get to the cheating, lying, and bribing that you describe in the book. Begin with trading up the chain.
Where do reporters find their stories? What people like me do is, knowing where the radar of the influencers is, we can register on that radar artificially and create sort of buzz and momentum that gets picked up and then reified through the rest of the media.
So give me an example of how you used it.
I opened the book with the story of the movie campaign that I did for the author Tucker Max. And what we did was we placed billboards strategically around the city of Los Angeles, which then I vandalized and took cell phone photos of and leaked to two local blogs in Los Angeles, Curbed LA and Fishbowl LA. knowing that they would bite on that story because it was someone they'd written about and someone they were interested in. They, of course, did. And then I took links to that story and I anonymously sent them to a bunch of bigger blogs, including blogs like The Village Voice and Gawker, who then picked it up. And then the next thing you know, we're being denounced in the editorial page of the Chicago Tribune and the Washington Post because these reporters read those sites and then they see their role as sort of a popularizer of the online buzz.
And these denunciations in the big national papers were a triumph.
Yeah, they were exactly what we wanted. It was one of those movies where the boycott is what makes everyone go to see it. And that's what we wanted to create.
And the movie was called?
I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell.
Not a huge amount of harm done in that case.
No.
But there are cases in which great harm is done. You use the example of Pastor Terry Jones, who threatened and then carried out the burning of the Quran, which resulted in riots in which 27 Afghan citizens were killed.
I think he started as a local sideshow. He would sort of do offensive things that pertain only to his church, to his local community, and he got the occasional story written about him by the local paper. That happens enough times, and now the Miami Herald takes notice. And now he's getting blog posts from all over the world. And when someone like Terry Jones sees suddenly that he has a national platform, he steps up his game. He gets crazier and crazier, and now he says, I'm going to burn a Quran. The media system can't police itself, and it can't say, no, we're clearly being manipulated here, let's not cover it, because the traffic is there, and traffic matters more than anything else.
And you quote a Wharton School research project, which looked at 7,000 articles on the New York Times most emailed list.
Yeah, and the number one predictor they found was anger. Anger is the number one predictor of an article making that most popular list. And it's not just anger, it's any high valence emotion. So humor is one, awe is another. But let's look at the emotions that aren't viral. Those are emotions like sadness or contentment or satisfaction. They're not in the interests of the media creators to propagate.
Now let's talk about bribing.
Let's talk about bribing. We all know that a blogger shouldn't write about, let's say, a stock that they've invested in. We know that's a clear conflict of interest. But since they're paid by the page view, I see every story they write as a potential conflict of interest. The way they write about it inherently biases them away from the truth and towards what will spread the fastest, what will take the least amount of work, and what will ultimately get the most amount of traffic.
So how did you bribe people?
You dangle the angle in front of them, right? I'll write a draft headline in an article, or I'll hint that this has a sexy picture attached to it.
So you bribe them with the promise of page views, but it isn't bribing with dollars.
In a way, it can also be that too. I mean, I buy advertisements for a variety of my clients, and if you're a one-man shop, you're the guy who's cashing the checks and writing the posts, and there's no way that that doesn't influence who and how you write about things.
Now talk about lying. Give me some examples of your more spectacular lies.
Something that broke last week is what I did through a service called Help a Reporter Out. It's basically a sort of a backroom service where someone says like, oh, I need a source for X, and a source says, oh, I'll be that source. And so I kind of felt like this site was leaving the front door wide open for people to come in and basically pretend to be experts about anything. And so what I did was for the last 6 months, I've pretended to be an expert on this service. I basically told anyone anything that they wanted to hear, even though I didn't know what I was talking about. I said, yeah, sure, I'm an expert on boats. I'm an expert on fitness or insomnia or various health issues. I'm an expert on vinyl records, and of course, I'm not an expert of vinyl records. I don't know what LP stands for. I don't own a turntable, but I was able to fake it enough to fool a reporter at the New York Times for a Sunday piece about a rising trend. When the reporter was ultimately questioned, he said he sounded somewhat credible and not all that different than the other people that I talked to. And that's what a New York Times reporter considers to be his burden of proof. To include someone in, you know, the paper of record.
You wrote that bloggers brandish the correction as though it is some magical balm that heals all wounds.
Bloggers justify this publish first, verify later model with the idea that it's so much easier to issue a correction online, right? You don't have to wait for the next day's paper to issue the correction. You can do it right there at the bottom of the story. But first off, psychologically, that just doesn't pass muster. They've done all sorts of interesting studies. And in fact, there's something called the backfire effect, where reading a correction actually makes you believe the mistake even more than the people who haven't seen the correction. And so that affects, like, let's say you're a publicly traded stock and a blog reports a rumor about your company. It doesn't matter that they corrected it 5 hours later, because your stock price still took an unnecessary hit because of it. And now investors are worried about your business.
There are these people who have snuck dangerous things onto planes. They say with the intention of showing how our airport security is really bad.
Right.
Do you worry that your book will be used more as a how-to than as a corrective?
It was something that I thought about a lot, but I ultimately felt like there was no other way to actually get people to pay attention. Not say this stuff could happen, but that this stuff does happen, and I know that because I personally did it.
Are you manipulating me?
I'm not. This is the question that I get most often about this book. I make a lot of money doing this in the shadows. There's a reason that there weren't many Google searches for my name as of a week ago. In order for me to function, I required secrecy. Since I no longer want that secrecy, I'm okay exposing this stuff.
Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The book is called Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator. Coming up, the sad tale of a campaign's botched background check on a vice presidential hopeful. No, not that vice presidential hopeful. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. You know you're being watched. Scrutiny that intensifies with every new online service you participate in, from mobile banking to the latest social networking site. There are already laws, both state and federal, on the books that protect consumer privacy. But the state of California is trying to ensure that enforcement keeps up with technology by creating a new Privacy Enforcement and Protection Unit. Kamala Harris is California's Attorney General. Kamala, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Brooke. It's great to be with you.
Do you think the fact that you are the Attorney General of California, maybe you're in a stronger position than many other state attorneys general?
Well, Brooke, I have to tell you, as a career prosecutor, I am fully aware of the big stick that we carry. I'm very proud as a Californian in the fact that in our backyard, the technology that is changing the way the world works is developing. It has improved the way we communicate. It has allowed us to be more efficient. However, in this beautiful new world, there are also vulnerable people, there are predators, and there is the potential for violation of privacy. So we created this unit of six prosecutors that I've assigned to investigate and prosecute whenever there's a violation of those laws that are designed to protect consumers.
What's the pattern of behavior that you're trying to fix?
For example, when a company has a data breach and it impacts over 500 Californians, that company must report it to my office.
Yeah, because there is a tendency for them to cover this stuff up.
Absolutely right, and which means that you, the consumer, will have no idea that your private information has been shared with someone you didn't intend or want to share it with. Another example is requiring privacy policies from mobile apps. We brought in the top internet marketplaces, Google and Amazon, Yahoo and a number of others. Most of them don't have a privacy policy, and the user needs to know that when they're downloading that mobile app, their entire contact list can be downloaded as well. We have put in place rules that require that the user is informed, and then let it be the choice of the user whether they want to give up some privacy in exchange for whatever benefit. So, for example, you know, a lot of us on our smartphones, we've downloaded the app for a flashlight. Well, if the technology were such that in order to have that flashlight, you'd have to give up your entire contact list, first and foremost, we need to let the user know. And then second, give the user the choice.
What do things like the mobile apps agreement or the new privacy enforcement and protection unit mean for consumers outside of California? Is a consumer in Detroit or Paris as well protected as a consumer in San Francisco?
The privacy policy that we created for mobile apps is having global impact because the user can be in any one of those places, in Paris, in Moscow, wherever. California is the biggest state in the country. It's the most populous. I think we're now the 8th largest economy in the world. So if something impacts a California consumer, it is likely to impact someone else somewhere else in the world.
If any of these companies has one California consumer, then they'll have to comply with these rules for all of their users.
That's the practical effect. The user in California will download the same app that the user in Missouri will download.
What if a California consumer uses services from companies that are not inside of California?
As long as a Californian is impacted, we will take jurisdiction.
In a recent post, a Wired.com writer named David Kravitz wrote that Silicon Valley has a policy of, quote, invading user privacy by default and apologizing for it later. Do you think that this new office will be able to change that culture?
It's been my experience so far that the companies that are creating this technology, when approached, they understand that if they are to enjoy a reputation of being a good corporate citizen, they have to comply with the law.
Kamala, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kamala Harris is the Attorney General of California. In more techno-intrusion news, in the past we've addressed the use of military drones on American soil where their potential for snooping has raised privacy concerns. Last year, we saw the first reported case of a government drone used in the arrest of an American citizen on his own land. It happened in North Dakota, a place apparently awash in drones. Mark Brunswick covers military affairs for the Star Tribune in Minnesota. He says the episode began when a farmer, Rodney Brossart, was tased and taken into custody after a rapidly escalating argument over six cows.
Fearful that his family might retaliate, authorities actually called in U.S. Customs and Border Protection Predator B, which is an unarmed drone. Actually, twice the drone was used to fly over the Brossart property to surveil what was going on there. It ended a 16-hour standoff in which Brossart and five members of his family were arrested.
The Brossards allegedly belong to the Sovereign Citizen Movement, an anti-government group that the FBI considers extremist, and there may have been some concern that the confrontation could have escalated into something very bloody.
Well, I actually spent 2 hours with Rodney and his family 2 weeks ago. He claims he's a simple farmer. They did confiscate some arms from the farm, stuff that you might find, at least in my mind, on any farm.
The charges were brought against the man, but they didn't cite any video from the drone. How do we know about how it was used?
Well, even Brossart's attorneys haven't seen what the drone saw. It wasn't until the reporter from the LA Times told Rodney's attorney that it had been used that they were even aware of it. The Brossart attorneys are seeking a dismissal, and as part of their discovery in the criminal case, they've sought to see the video, and nobody's produced it until yet.
So what's the deal with North Dakota? Recently, the University of North Dakota started offering a 4-year degree in unmanned aircraft piloting. How did North Dakota get to be the center of this kind of activity?
It's the first in the country to offer a degree in piloting drones. Nearby at a local community college was the first in the country to offer a degree in mechanics of fixing drones. North Dakota historically is very aviation-centric. It has two Air Force bases, and its Air National Guard unit actually flies drones that are piloted in Fargo but flown in Iraq and Afghanistan. The airspace is what we know as pristine, which means there's not a lot of there. It's not well-trafficked.
In your recent piece, you wrote that the American Civil Liberties Union is worried about all of this. You quote it saying, all the pieces appear to be lining up for the eventual introduction of routine aerial surveillance in American life. How so?
Well, there is some case law related to manned surveillance, which applies as well to unmanned surveillance. But there's some issues related to drones that still have yet to be worked out. The efficiency and a lack of cost in putting a drone in the air certainly makes it much more easy to just have them there, and the potential for violations of privacy is just sort of exponentially increased.
There haven't been yet any documented intrusions of privacy by domestic drones, right? It's possible we wouldn't know about them.
That's part of the deal, yeah. Actually, North Dakota is working with law enforcement to develop procedures and policies related to drone use. So it really is in its infancy. To say that we don't know that it hasn't happened doesn't mean that it hasn't happened.
I don't know why I'm not more upset about this. I mean, they can be a real boon to public safety, right?
Oh, absolutely. You can use them for search and rescue. They are used that way. The Predator that was used on the Brossard case also was used to monitor flooding in the Red River Valley. And they can be used to spot wildfires, hot spots before they get out of control. So there's a huge number of humanitarian and commercial uses. The funny thing is, when you think about it, a cell phone or the internet is just as capable of violating your privacy as a drone. It's just sort of the visceral nature of something hanging over your head and sort of all seeing is human emotion attached to it.
They're not all big, though. I mean, some of them can fit in the palm of your hand.
That's right. The more ominous ones, the Predator and the Reaper, are larger ones. I just saw last week a less ominous sounding one from the Army called a Shadow, which is about 14 feet long. But yeah, there's one called the Hummingbird.
They should probably just rename them, you know, the Tweety Bird, the Fluffy Cloud.
I think we'd all be more comfortable.
Mark, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Mark Brunswick covers military affairs for the Star Tribune in Minnesota. Mitt Romney's choice of a running mate, due any day now, is hugely consequential to the campaign and seriously, seriously secret. One thing we do know, what the campaign wants to avoid above all else, is surprises. Perhaps the rudest of those surprises, an enduring object lesson, came in 1972 when George McGovern picked a Missouri senator, Thomas Eagleton, to be his veep in the race against Richard Nixon. McGovern did virtually no background check, and the conversation in which he asked and Eagleton accepted took a mere 67 seconds.
3 minutes ago, George McGovern called and he said, "Tom, I've got a favor to ask of you." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "I want you to be my running mate." And I think I said something like, "I hastily accept," before he could retract it and withdraw it.
Clearly, McGovern didn't know much about his running mate, and neither did the press, which was sent scrambling. In an interview we first ran in 2007, we spoke with reporter Clark Hoyt, who in 1972 was a cub reporter for the Knight Ridder newspaper chain. He said that while he was reading up on the man who was to serve as the Democrats' vice presidential nominee for a mere 18 days, his lead fell into his lap.
An anonymous caller called the Detroit Free Press, one of our newspapers, and asked to speak to John S. Knight, who was the founding father of Knight newspapers. The operator connected the caller to John S. Knight III, his grandson, who was an editorial writing intern at the Free Press. The caller said that he knew that Senator Eagleton had suffered from depression and had been treated with electroshock therapy on more than one occasion. And this caller was sure that the Republicans would find this out and use it in some underhanded way during the political campaign, so the caller believed it should get out immediately.
What did you do with the tip?
Well, even before I learned about the tip, I went to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And I asked them if I could use their library and read all of their clips on Senator Eagleton. Newspaper clips in the old-fashioned envelopes are really quite revealing things. And what I saw were, in a very vivid, active public career, there would suddenly be gaps that would be unexplained. Sometimes there might be just a small paragraph that would say, "Senator Eagleton has been at the Mayo Clinic for a physical exam," or "Senator Eagleton has been exhausted and taking a rest," something like that. So there was already a red flag. When I got the tip, it had more credibility than it might have had otherwise.
So once the facts lined up, or at least the flags lined up, did you go to the campaign?
No. I started looking for a doctor whose name we got from the tipster. And this doctor was no longer in practice, so it was quite difficult initially to locate the person. But I did, and I, in a very nervous voice, I said, I'm Clark Hoyt from Night Newspapers in Washington, and I want to talk to you about the time in March of 1961 when Senator Eagleton was treated with electroshock therapy at Renard Hospital in St. Louis. The doctor looked at me in horror, and as she slammed the door in my face, she said, I can't talk to you about that.
And so what happened after that?
Well, Robert S. Boyd, my bureau chief, and I worked on this together, and ultimately we wound up with a two-page memo that we did take then to Senator McGovern's campaign. What we didn't know at the time was he already knew. We understand that the same tipster had called the McGovern campaign and told them the same information. What we were told is, Senator Eagleton is on his way out here. You'll have an interview with him. We're as determined as you are to get to the bottom of it. Within a day or so, we knew that we were being strung along. What they finally decided to do was to have an immediate press conference and have Senator Eagleton announce his mental health history.
On three occasions in my life, I have voluntarily gone into hospitals as a result of nervous exhaustion and fatigue. As a younger man, I must say that I drove myself too far.
And in answer to a question, he said part of his treatment was shock therapy.
That's right. Big news at that point. The campaign had sort of broken, in my view, an unwritten rule between reporters and campaigns, in the sense that we had a story and they simply announced it to the world. And so in what they themselves referred to as a consolation prize, they put us in a car, Bob Boyd and I, in a car with Senator Eagleton to drive from Custer back to Rapid City, South Dakota, and the airport. Senator Eagleton was sitting in the back seat. I was next to him, asking him questions all the way to fill in the profile of him that I had originally been assigned to do. He was very gracious, answered every question, some quite uncomfortable questions. Throughout it, he chain-smoked the entire time. He was perspiring profusely, and by the end of the ride, I was soaking wet from him.
And you probably understood that that was the end of his vice presidential ambitions and possibly the end of his political career. What did you think of the consequences of your actions, or did you at all?
Yes, we thought a lot about the consequences of our actions, and Bob Boyd and I have talked about it a number of times. And we always felt that it was a story that was appropriately in the public domain. We don't know everything about Senator Eagleton's medical history. He never released any records. He never authorized his doctors to talk publicly about his case. But what we do know suggests that under great stress, or at times right after great stress, he tended to shut down. And on at least two occasions, he required hospitalization and the shock therapy. And for someone who was aspiring to be vice president of the United States, the proverbial heartbeat away from the presidency, I always felt that this was relevant information about his qualifications, his fitness, if you will, for the job. I don't see how we would have done it any differently.
Given what you learned about Thomas Eagleton, were you convinced he wouldn't have been a good vice president?
You know, that's a very good question. I am convinced that he was a very good senator, and he was reelected twice after that. He could have been reelected from Missouri as many times as he wanted to be. He was a very effective senator. He was one of the leaders in the War Powers Act in the Vietnam era. In private life, afterward in St. Louis, he was a commanding figure in Missouri politics. He taught law at Washington University. He was obviously a man who had a very full and rich public career. He might have been a fine vice president, but the question really is, could he have been a good president? And I don't think we really know the answer to that, because we don't really know what the nature of his condition was, whether it was all ancient history or whether under stress it might have been repeated again. We just don't know that.
Clark, thank you very much.
Brooke, thank you for asking me.
Clark Hoyt, who's recently served as the public editor of the New York Times, and Robert Boyd won the 1973 Pulitzer Prize for their Eagleton reporting.
Surely I did not expect to stand before you tonight as the Democratic nominee for Vice President of the United States. I commit myself to the difficult task that lies ahead because I think all of the surprises of 1972 have shown us something very important. We're learning to find opportunity in them, not just uncertainty and not just fear.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Amy DePiro and Eliza Novick-Smith, and edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.